Welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. I'm your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
This is John, and that is my 15-year-old's new favorite song, and it's the stupidest looking album ever, but the music's pretty fun.
Ooh, what does it look like? I'm a sucker for album covers.
I can show you a picture, but I don't even know if I can describe it. This artist has got like a sombrero strung over his back and this really lousy looking face tattoo.
Kind of like a Michael Jackson-y kind of look.
Plus
sombrero, yeah.
Can we say positively that Michael Jackson never wore a sombrero?
He probably did. He probably did at some point.
Probably.
With everything else he wore. I'm sure he wore a sombrero. So I let's just like dive in like we haven't taken 5 months off from this podcast. I want to know what you guys think about the Kavanaugh debacle right now. And we didn't talk about this at all beforehand. I just want like first impressions. Do you guys think it's a joke? Do you think do you feel like this is an incredibly serious thing? I saw yesterday that women are staging protests and wearing black and walking out with like the hashtag believe. And I see other people who are in complete support of Kavanaugh and are making like, are saying like, we have to rush this appointment through as fast as possible. I just want your like quick fire take on the Kavanaugh situation. Go, David.
Heck yeah.
Heck yeah, what?
I think that this has been something that's happened to conservative justices before when they've been nominated. Clarence Thomas. I think it happened to Thomas Bork too. And looking at the evidence looks pretty...
Wasn't it Robert Bork?
Flimsy. Is that it? Robert Bork?
I'll figure it out. Go ahead.
Isn't that what I said?
Looking at the evidence, you think it's pretty flimsy.
I think the evidence looks pretty flimsy. That's not to say we shouldn't hear what she has to say, but I have a big problem with what's happening in our culture right now, where there's no due process with anything.
That there are protests being staged and walkouts. It's a partisan issue of believe this or don't believe this is being used. It's a partisan divide.
No. I have the problem that anybody can make an accusation and there's no presumption of innocence. Mm. So you can have a perfectly upstanding person have somebody come and accuse them of raping them, of doing something horrible. And because of the cultural climate that we're living in now, the accuser is going to be believed with no evidence and the person's life is going to be ruined. I have a big problem with that.
Okay, so I want to chime in and I kind of have a big problem with what you're saying and kind of agree with what you're saying.
Ooh, good.
So I think that the internet mob mentality we have of convicting people in the public square without any due process about any kind of issue. I mean, we've internet mobbed people for shooting lions. We've internet mobbed people for making bad jokes on Twitter. We've internet mobbed people for a lot of things. And that culture of outrage is just incredibly unhealthy. But the big problem I have is the kind of the framing of it. Like, we've had this this has happened to conservative justices before, as if the accusations are things that are being done to innocent people for sure, which is a presumption of innocence without evidence as well.
Well, okay, so
instead of like, we've had, we could just as reasonably frame this as, wow, we nominate a lot of conservative justices who have rapey tendencies.
Well.
Rapey tendencies? That's horrible.
It's not something we're
laughing about.
So, it is horrible.
I would say, in agreement to what you're saying, what's the rush?
Like, yeah.
There's no rush to appoint him. This isn't an election. There's no timetable.
Not only is there no...
Unless we're just trying to flex our partisan power.
Well, not only is there no rush to appoint him, there's no reason to believe, as a conservative, there's no reason to believe that he's our one and only hope for a conservative justice on the court.
But that is the only way we like that's the terminology that we do every election in, and every, it's the last and only chance.
Oh yeah, so, yeah. This is our last hope. What was there, some kind of press conference or something?
His name is Obi-Wan Kavanaugh.
So I want to make sure I'm being clear here,
right,
that I think that looking at the evidence of what happened in the situation with like Roy Moore during the election,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think it's pretty clear that Roy Moore was a creep.
Okay.
When he was way too old to, when he was much well, too
there's
old.
No,
to
there's
know
no
better.
Age where
I
mean, it's okay to be a creep, but yes, yeah, I yeah, totally yeah, yeah. agree
I mean,
with
he
you.
Was, yeah. He was much too old and he was being a creep with these young ladies and following
yeah, right,
them
right.
around. And he
there was overwhelming evidence of a pattern of behavior.
Yes.
And so it was reasonable to say, let's not vote for this guy, even though we're not convicting him in a court of law. There's enough evidence that he's not worthy of our vote.
Exactly. And yes. And I'm absolutely not going to stand up and say, well, you know, because we need to vote for him because he's the Republican. Or, you know, I don't think there should be partisan.
Or even that we need to vote for him because nothing was proved in a court of law.
Sure. I think that looking at the situation, I think it was pretty clear that he had some, as you say, some rapey tendencies.
I
don't know if that's the...
Well, we're talking about horrible things.
I don't know.
I don't mean to be
right.
Sure.
But dismissive. So I felt that it didn't look very good for him, and I did not like what I saw in conservatives saying, well, you know, it's okay. I'm really not okay with conservatives saying, well, it's okay that, you know, Donald Trump did all these horrible things.
Or conservatives saying, well, what he did as a 17-year-old, like all 17-year-old boys, what 17-year-old boy hasn't made poor choices or something like that.
Right. That line of defense is
making dismissive
ridiculous.
Kind of statements sure. about this being because he was 17 or because this like that, those kinds of lines of thinking are so contrary to what I would say is Judeo-Christian values, not just conservative values, but Christian values, which is the great irony, I think, in this conversation, yeah. because the hypocrisy on both sides of this conversation is so just, it's almost humorous. Like, I think we'll look back at this and see almost the comedic element to this, because mm-hmm. on the one hand, we have liberals who supported a president who used his power and position to seduce a young intern and defended it like it was consensual and no big deal. And yet it's clear that Clinton wasn't going to get that favor. He wasn't going to get that opportunity, except for the fact that he was a powerful person. And that was he was using his position and power to obtain quote unquote consent, as opposed to, and now we're all riled up over, Kavanaugh and the lack of consent with one witness and not seeing the irony there. Like, and then conservatives who railed against Clinton's behavior and yet seemed to be,
okay,
perfectly
this
comfortable
is, this
with
is
potentially
Donald Trump,
potentially dismissive of yes, right. perfectly fine right. with Trump. We leave out Kavanaugh entirely because again, there is the presumption of innocence.
Yeah,
and so, but I think we need to hear the accusations.
So in the Trump situation, clearly we have recording of Trump being
gross,
really
having,
gross,
having rapey tendencies.
Yes, having rapey tendencies.
I'm so glad to have added new things to your vocabulary.
There's the title of this podcast.
Rapey
no.
tendencies.
No, no,
well,
no.
It will probably send our listenership soaring.
Oh Lord,
have mercy.
So clearly.
Clearly,
we,
conservatives
with,
are
we need
okay
move
with
forward.
On-record terribleness from our president. But we're not dealing with the exact
right,
same situation
right.
with Kavanaugh.
Right, we're not, because Kavanaugh has absolutely said, no way, I did not do this.
Right, but the wrinkle, I think, in this is not that conservatives are saying, hey, this hasn't been proven, we can't throw him out without proving it. There are some people who are saying that, I'm sure. I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not out on everything.
That, yeah.
But there is a lot of conversation going on where purportedly conservative voices are saying things like, well, he was 17. I'd hate to live in a world where what I did when I was 17 could be held against me forever.
Okay, which is interesting because on the one hand, I agree with that.
I wanted to talk about that.
On the other hand,
there is no other hand.
Wow.
No. I'm just making Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay,
jokes.
But okay. So on the one hand, I am not dismissing that our behaviors are incredibly important at whatever age. That is, in and of itself, a conservative idea. And so if Kavanaugh was going to parties as a 17-year-old and getting wasted, he may not remember what he was doing. And that sounds like there's more probability that he was at least going to parties and getting drunk. And it's typically liberals who are like, oh, yeah, when you're 17, just do whatever you want to do. Have sex, go to parties, do it. And so the Christian idea is what is really countercultural and says, hold on a second, time out, what? What are we saying is okay to do? Just be safe in your sex? That's the thing that's truly countercultural. And that's the thing that will really, really tick off the left or liberals, is saying, no. That's not how we're going to raise.
There's right and there's wrong.
There's right, there's wrong. There's values. Mm-hmm. Sexuality is something that was intended for
marriage only.
And marriage only. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really the radical position that I wish we were hearing from conservatives rather than...
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. So you were just saying...
You said so five times.
I know. It's because I'm trying to get
I'm all worked up. Okay.
It's like
so
I had
you
coffee.
Wanted to defend the what I did when I was 17 shouldn't affect me for the rest of my life.
I am saying, should we... If you
attempted to rape someone when you were 17, it should affect the rest of your life.
I don't necessarily mean that.
Okay.
Exactly. So I think if you attempted to rape somebody, I think
you've been disqualified for a lot of things in life. You can still be a human being. We can still love you. You can still be a member of the church. You can mature. You can repent. You can turn your life around. But you are now disqualified from a lot of things, including positions of high trust.
So I'm asking myself here, mm-hmm. does...
Whoa. Okay, yeah, keep going.
No.
I want you to be able to respond, yeah.
I think I'm agreeing with what you're saying.
Okay.
But I'm asking myself, is 40 years of faithful service and upstanding living and being...
Is it redemptive?
Wonderful part of the community. Is it redemptive?
Okay,
is it?
So,
I don't know. Is it?
Well,
I'm asking myself.
That's
asking
a big
you.
Question.
Well, we don't let a president. We don't let a person be a president if they're a felon.
Okay.
So
sure.
Right.
So yes, we do have things that we're just going to say those are knockouts. And if you were 17 and you attempted to rape somebody, that's a felony. I'm going to be extra conservative here. I don't really care if you're 17 or you're 18.
Sure.
That's mm-hmm. that's improper. It
of
just
course.
Is it's just
of
wrong.
Course.
So, and should it be a knockout thing? Yes. But
it should definitely be also, a knockout thing for SCOTUS.
Why for SCOTUS as a
Well,
as
because
it, to,
because it's a position of high trust. And okay. also for I would say if we're leaving this up to me, which of course I think we should.
Queen Amanda.
Yes.
Executive
Queen of all
powers
the
world.
No,
bestowed.
Please no. But it should definitely be a disqualifier for any position of high trust. Like if you're in a, if you've really
How about
attempted
Catholic priest?
Definitely. You can't be a pastor. You can't be, you probably shouldn't be a therapist.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other good examples, but you shouldn't be in a position of trust. Go and do something that's not a position of high trust.
But then there's another wrinkle in here.
Electrician.
Yeah, it's or
yeah,
home inspector.
Home inspector.
That's right.
But there's another wrinkle here, and that's if Kavanaugh did do it, and the defense that he was 17. Well, he's also now denied it.
Right.
So if he did do it and then denied it,
completely disqualifies him. Absolutely.
There's just
100%.
No question.
Yes. So if it comes out somehow and is categorically proven that he did, I think there's just no way.
So this is the interesting question. I wonder if this is where we're going to end up. So what happens? She gives her testimony. She remembers one thing. Mm-hmm. He remembers another thing. We don't have any verifiable other,
evidence.
It seems like, with the Crosby situation, with Bill Cosby, we had him, you know, we had other women come forward. It was proven, blah, blah, blah.
Well, haven't other women come forward by now with Kavanaugh? I thought it was a headline in passing.
There's another one. There's another one today that pops up, and her story is even worse. It's much flimsier.
It's
more tangential and not.
It really looks like the opposition is digging up people to go after him, is what it looks like.
Okay.
The second woman came out and said that he exposed himself to her at a party.
Okay.
But then, like, if just from the preliminary things that I've read, like the other people who she recalls being at the party with don't remember going to the party, or they don't remember him being at
the
party.
So it's not acting as a in a strongly confirming way because we're not getting.
But it's very. I mean, I don't know enough about the situation yet to.
Let me finish my question.
So here's the question. So she comes forward. She gives all of her. Testimony.
It's not conclusive. He comes forward,
there's nothing conclusive. So then what happens? So then do Republicans just muscle their way through? And do Democrats just stand up and say, well, this is why this pro-life guy gets put into a position of authority, because he's got rapey tendencies. And of course he's pro-life, because that's what all these turds are.
They just want to control women.
They just want to control women.
Right.
And see that we're controlling them through their reproductive one way or the other.
Right.
And that's kind of the stalemate that I am anticipating this is going to come down to. And that will be interesting.
Right.
That's going to be fascinating.
Which makes me wonder why we didn't just nominate a woman in the first place.
Which there was a good candidate as a woman, and it seems like that would have been a lot of
sense. There was a really good candidate from what I, the tiny little bit I read about.
So what you're suggesting there is a woman is less likely to have rape tendencies.
I was just trying to figure out how to say that.
I mean, I want to go out on a limb here and say that
you walked into it.
Statistics really support that position.
Well, you know what? That would only be allowed if you weren't, if you didn't believe that men and women were equal in all respects and didn't have certain tendencies in certain ways, blah, 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 blah,
blah. Blah, 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 blah.
Okay, that's enough of that. I'm sick of talking about it. I had heartburn. Every time I flip on the radio, every station's talking about it. Doesn't matter who or what. Except I've been listening almost exclusively to sports radio, and then I like try to pick up on it. My last thought is this. This is the best Twitter thing I've seen on the whole thing, and it's from the liberal position. And they said this. It's interesting how people who are so confident of what happened 2,000 years ago can't believe a story from 30 years ago. And I thought, oh my gosh.
That's a compelling thought.
I don't agree with that in any way, with either of you agreeing with that.
Here's where I actually... I don't think that just the timing issue is the compelling part of that, so much as the what is a plausible thing to believe in any context. And like you've commented a couple of times that the details of the story are murky, and I really haven't read much about this. I actually hard deleted my Facebook and my Twitter to try and retain some shred of sanity in this crazy world. But the idea that elite kids at elite private institutions were having parties at wealthy people's houses and were getting drunk, and there was lots of privacy and there were lots of opportunities and there was a culture of permissiveness toward this kind of thing is like the least shocking thing in the world. Like that's absolutely what I would expect from a privileged group of overfunded and undersupervised kids.
My only thought is allow due process to take its course. We're not in a rush.
Sure.
Kavanaugh's going to be he's what, 50? He's going to be...
He's got another 45 years.
He's got another 30 years of being in a position of influence, 25 years of being in a position of influence. Spend a couple more weeks. Let's hear her testimony. Let's hear his testimony. Let this play itself out. To push it through feels like partisanship. There's no rush.
I don't think it's a hill to die on.
And having said all that,
that's not our salvation.
Having said that, I like Kavanaugh. And the times I've heard him, I've liked what I've heard. But that's not evidence. Not that, and we may my not ever feeling, have evidence.
Your gut feeling isn't evidence.
My gut feeling is not evidence. And the truth is, we may not have ever have evidence. We may have her memories from 30 years ago and his recollections from 30 years ago, and that's it. And what she told her therapist 5 or 6 years ago.
So the problems I have with the tweet is it's such a, is it false equivalency?
Yes,
it's,
it is probably false equivalency.
I mean, definitely.
You have the story of Jesus Christ 2,000 years ago, which is incredibly well documented, and the historical sources are beyond.
We have a woman who's claiming virgin birth. That is not incredibly well documented. There is no way of proving that. So if we're going to, there, the virgin birth part of it is.
I'm smiling over here. I'm speechlessly laughing.
Virgin birth's tough. That's a tough one.
That one's been claimed a few times in history too.
It has. But the one that seems the only one that seems to keep on coming back is this gal named Mary.
Yeah. Oh goodness.
So.
But the story of Jesus Christ and his life and his death and the impact that he had on history is a pretty well-established thing. And to compare that to the story that already has all of these very severe holes in it and reeks of partisanship.
You're talking about very severe holes, but given what we know about the way trauma works and the way memory works and the way that survivors process things, what we perceive as holes are very often very normal parts of the process of dealing with trauma. I've read some, I can't quote any of it and therefore be actually a helpful contributing member of the conversation.
This is why when they had the trial, I forget who it was, or I'm forgetting her name right now, but when they did the trial of whether, there was a slander trial. There was a woman, a teacher, who was in New York, who was saying that the claims of the Jews at Auschwitz being annihilated were all, there was a guy who
Holocaust denial,
and she was saying this is stupid. He sued her for libel, and so they went through court, and she eventually won. But it was very difficult to prove, like, that you had to actually go through the process of proving the Holocaust happened, and her defense would not let Jewish survivors of the Holocaust give testimony. And it killed her because she wanted to put them up on the stand. And the problem is the way survivors actually process it, there's holes in their story. And so they'll say, well, I remember this happened in this place at this time. And then when they're cross-examined, their memories have holes in it. So they'll say, I remember this happened in this room. And they're like, oh yeah, where was the door? And you said the door was on the left. Yeah, the door was on the left. I remember distinctly that the door is on the left. And then they bring up a picture and the door is not on the left. It's on the far end of the room. And they're like, so this, and that's the problem. But again, if it's two people's memories, we've talked about this way too long. All right,
seriously,
Amanda, what did you want to talk about tonight? Because this is so painful.
So, by way of transition,
this is the worst.
I don't know if this is by way of transition or not, but we were having a conversation, not on microphone, weeks ago about, I think, John, you and I were talking about books that we wanted our kids to read, and you were talking about
books that change your life.
Right.
Yeah, books that change your way of how books could be written or whatever, yeah.
Right, but books that changed your idea of what a book could do.
Sure.
And you were talking about wanting to share a book with your son because it had changed your idea of what a book could do, and it had changed your perspective on some important things in life.
Right.
And so we got to thinking about how that would be a really good thing to talk about. What book, not like what was the most important book for you ever, but what was the book that changed your perspective on what books were for or what books were capable of?
Right. Yeah. And not even necessarily what's the best book I've ever read.
Right, right.
My favorite book. Yeah. So when I was a teenager, I read The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck. And that altered my idea of the purpose of a novel, because it's not a happily ever after novel.
Not so much.
No, it's not at all. And there are certainly points where you're like, oh, good. But then there's just a lot of cringing in the book in general.
Yes.
And then I don't know exactly the best format of doing this, but the story, if you're not familiar with the story is of a young farmer whose father, the book just picks up and starts talking about his father going and finding him a wife. And it's in this rural, I think 18th century, 19th century, maybe 19th century. I think that's what it is. Chinese rural village. And Buck does this great job. She was a missionary kid. She does this great job describing the lifestyle and values and culture and day-to-day routine of Chinese people. Mm-hmm. It's such a foreign concept, and the things that are happening in it, it could have been science fiction.
Right. Because it's such a different culture.
It is another world. Mm-hmm. It is another planet. So the book kicks off talking about how he's going to find him a plain wife. Right. So that she has not been...
Because
the servants who live in the household that he's going to have rapey tendencies. Apparently, they're all Supreme Court justice nominees. And
what this podcast is going to be titled.
And so he's trying to find his son. It doesn't come out. I haven't read it in years, but he's trying to find his son, a wife who has not been molested
right.
her entire...
So a strong, plain woman.
A strong, plain woman. And really the hero...
And he gets one.
Yes. And the hero of the book, for the rest of the book, you don't realize it until near the end of the book, is her. It's not the farmer. He's the one who we follow. He's the story that we follow. But she is really the hero mm-hmm. or the heroine of the book. And then you follow their story and how...
Well, she creates the family prosperity. Yeah, she, through her efforts, she holds the family together.
She kills a kid.
Yeah.
She sells a daughter into slavery.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Sells a daughter into slavery and like steals jewels from a rich person's house during it's all over the place. And it was the first book that I read that felt so amoral. And the guiding principle through the entire book is not the Ten Commandments, not a sense of obligation or being a good person or do the right thing or, you know, the golden rule. It is the good earth. It is this farmer's mentality. Like if you buy property and plant stuff in it, it will give you a return. So just buy property. And you're like, oh, man. And then at the end of the book, total spoiler alert. His sons are talking about his sons who've kind of become like wheelers and dealers and financiers and bankers and stuff. They're starting to talk about selling up the land. And the dad's like, just keep the land, keep the good earth. And they're like, nah, we got this, dad. We got this figured out. Old guy.
Right.
And so they like compromise the very essence of the book in the last sequence of the book. And you're like, oh, gosh. Well, that sucked.
And you feel so discouraged for him, even though you kind of hated him for being so... Because he's very cruel to his wife.
Finds a mistress.
She eventually is... Yeah. Well, or I think he even... Does he marry the second woman?
He does.
Second wife?
He does, but she ends up dying before the first one. I forget if she does. She ends up... But the long story short, I forget which one dies first, but he ends up honoring his first wife more than his second wife in how he buries her and how he honors her afterlife. Great. That's a great way of doing it.
Don't give your life up for your wife as Christ gave his life up for the church, but you know, just make sure she has a good gravestone.
A big tombstone.
That's good.
Fascinating. Best book. Best book I read probably in high school, as far as like just literary expansion of ideas.
So could you expand a little bit on what it is about that book that transformed for you what a book could do? What was it that shifted? And what makes you want to share it with your son?
So I kind of hinted at it, but I think the amoral compass was really powerful for me to realize, wait a minute, there is not everybody is operating from the same set of values that I am. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that we weren't working, that the story was linear in the sense of there wasn't a happily ever after, and we were just telling a series of events, and that the conclusion may not be one that I would agree with.
Right.
That the characters may be people I identified with, and that might be the value, not the conclusions.
Right.
And so that was in and of itself pretty. Pretty powerful. I should go back and reread it because so Ethan's going to read it this year, and that's my plan is to reread it with him.
That's really good.
So yeah.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, for you, it was Till We Have Faces?
Well, yeah. And I think what it is about Till We Have Faces, besides being, again...
Which was also a book I read in high school and hated.
You hated it?
I hated it.
Well, I think high school, without help, I think high school is a little early for it.
Well, and as we've already established, I'm not a woman, so I think I wonder if that may have something. I mean, I'm being completely honest. I think
wait,
I had
when
trouble.
Did we establish you're not a woman? I'm confused.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Was that in the pre-podcast?
maybe I was trying to reference back to your allusion. Oh, the best Supreme Court justice would be a woman.
Not the best, but you know the one that's least likely to get accused of rape.
Perhaps. And okay. But I wonder if that may have been part of the reason I struggled in high school, because I needed to identify with a male character more, because I just didn't have the maturity.
But I actually think that that's one of the things that's interesting about The Good Earth, and why I think that The Good Earth was probably a good book for you to read, and why I think it'd be a really good book for Ethan to read, is because it gave such a window into the struggle and the pain of being a woman in a culture that didn't appreciate women.
Yeah,
and I
totally.
Think that that's a really good thing to hear and to have to try to process.
Yeah.
Till We Have Faces, I don't know if I want to say the psychology of it, but the moral insight and the psychological insight of the novel really shifted something for me.
No, but now, how old were you when you read this? Because I think I was probably 15, 16 when I read
the book. I was older than that. Okay. So I was not allowed to read anything by C.S. Lewis when I was growing up because there's a witch
he was related
in
to J.K.
Lion the Witch.
Rowling.
Well, yeah. Don't make me defend it, but
moving forward.
So I think I was probably 20 or 21.
Okay.
I may have been as young as 19. Okay. I don't remember exactly when I first read it. Now, I've reread it at least once a year ever since, sometimes more than once. But what it was about that book that just was astonishing and wonderful to me was Lewis's insight into... And his ability to articulate the way the mind works to justify itself and to defend itself, how good we are at re-narrating our own story to make ourselves the hero. And maybe you didn't sympathize with it as much because it's a female protagonist, but maybe that's why I did. But I think actually one of the things that's astonishing about Lewis's accomplishment there is that I feel like the psychology of the main character is distinctly feminine. I identified very strongly with her, and that some of the things that she thought and felt and were concerned about were things that, and I don't know that I thought about this while I was reading it, but on reflection, like how did, you know, 50 something year old Lewis have such clear insight into the way a woman's mind would work, her specific negotiations with herself about her appearance and how her appearance shapes how people treat her, and the particular pain of being regarded as a companion but not as a woman by men she admires and a man that she would like to have love her, to have him be interested in her as a fellow soldier.
Romantically and relationally, right.
She's interested in him romantically and relationally as a companion, but is both pleased that he forgets she's a woman and pained by it. And that it was astonishing to me.
So if my memory's correct, there's not a happy ending in this book either.
No. Well, so, no, there is. I mean, her life doesn't have a happy ending, but her afterlife does. In one of the visions, she stands before the gods, is judged and found wanting, mm-hmm. and then is given redemption because her sister gives it to her. Mm-hmm. And she's made beautiful and in soul and body by her sister's sacrifice. So it is a happy ending in that sense, but not...
See, I still don't feel like that's happy. That doesn't sound happy to me.
Well, yeah, maybe not in the traditional book sense of happy ending.
Right, right, right.
That is the happy ending you're looking forward to in life, right?
Well, I mean, for lack of a better way, like the way I've been indoctrinated is the Disney happy ending where
and they you ride happily
on a,
ever after.
Yeah, the happily ever after on a flying carpet or in a, you know, a pumpkin carriage or something like that.
Right.
It's really interesting that you would say that you said that about how could Lewis have known what it was like to be inside a woman's head like
right.
that?
Right, which is, I think, an initial response, but also I think it has to do with his psychological insight into what it means to be human, and mm-hmm. we are fundamentally human, and he was able to inhabit that imagination and some specifically feminine concerns, but because he understood the way humanity worries, the way humanity has anxieties,
frets.
Yeah. And so he's able to cast them in a feminine mold in just in some specific instances. There's plenty in the book that's, I think, pretty universal. There are just a few things that seemed really uniquely insightful.
It's really interesting. I was just reading this week online in a discussion group talking about Lewis and his portrayal of women. And mm-hmm. the discussion was the suggestion was made that Lewis's portrayal of women was always a little weird and a little off.
You know, I wrote my master's thesis on that exact thing, right?
Wow, that is interesting. I think I must have forgotten that.
Okay, so give us your 30-second take on what is your take on that then?
Well, just that...
No, not yours. I want the master's thesis.
Oh,
sorry.
You're looking at David.
20 minutes on a chat room doesn't quite equal a master's thesis, right. But...
So,
did you feel like that was that assessment was insightful? Did it? Do you think that his portrayal of women is odd or off?
I think that his strongest portrayals are the male portrayals. I think
really
those are the more memorable characters.
Oh, and I totally disagree. But I think I can think of three main characters. That are his three strongest characters, and two are female and one is male.
Okay, so what are the three characters, just out of curiosity?
Ransom in the Cosmic Trilogy.
Okay, good.
Arul in Till We Have Faces, okay. And Lucy. Lucy's.
How did you not say the witch in any of those options there?
Because they're not strong characters. They're cartoon villains.
Yeah.
And also, the witch is what kept me from being able to read the Chronicles of Narnia when I was a little kid.
So you really
and
hate
so
her.
I really, really hate her. Darn that witch. If it was the lion in the wardrobe, I would have been fine.
Yeah.
So you think his strongest characters are male?
Well, I just, as I think through the Chronicles of Narnia, I think maybe it really is just my, like, I tend to, I guess, relate better to Peter and to
See, now here Eustace we're going back and... to some profound gender issues in our culture. Did you know that men read, 90% of the books that men read are written by men?
That doesn't surprise me.
That's interesting.
And for women,
it's far more...
It's like 60-40.
Yeah. And that doesn't surprise me in part because I know my own tendencies. Like, I don't think I read... I think I only read a handful of novels by women at an earlier age, and that was intentional on my part.
Right. You sought out books by men and avoided books by women.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Which I think has a lot to do with the way that our culture socializes... those issues, like we talk,
right. Jane Eyre's books are silly for men to read.
Well, Jane Eyre didn't write books.
I'm sorry, I meant Jane Austen.
Okay,
yeah. I'm thinking Jane Eyre because Melissa and Ethan are starting that book this week.
Oh, so much
but Jane Austen was who I
intended to say. Oh, that's such a great book.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which I have read. I've read Jane Eyre.
I find it very easy to identify with a male main character when I read a book. Like there's no sense of that's not for me. Or, and Ursula Le Guin wrote a wonderful essay.
Left Hand of Art, Darkness.
No, well, she wrote a wonderful book called The Left Hand of Darkness, but okay. She wrote a wonderful essay called I Am a Man. And her point was that all these books she read had taught her that she needed to be a hero, and the vast majority of the heroes are men.
I'm not
so
a man.
Mm-hmm. So she identified herself with them. And so in some weird sense, she identified herself as a man.
Yeah, Hannah is making this valiant stand right now to not read Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit because there are no strong female characters.
Mm.
And I was like, I can't disagree with that. Like, mm-hmm. you can say Eowyn, but she really, her character is not a strong thrust in the in the stories. Her action is important.
Right. But she's not a strong
valiant
character.
And she is given honor because of that, but not.
But she's the only one. Arwen is
Arwen's a nothing.
Much less.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. She's a romantic interest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Subplot. And literally there are two women. Well, three.
Galadriel is the other one that would be.
No, that's true. I wasn't thinking about her, but of course she is.
Yeah.
And interestingly, a stronger character than her own husband.
Oh, totally.
Dramatically so.
Yeah. Priscilla. Galadriel and Teledor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's certainly philosophically defensible, but not aesthetically, because The Lord of the Rings is well worth her time. But I think that, you know, give her Tahanu, or she's probably already read it.
No, she hasn't read those yet. But we're getting off track. Yes, I agree. Books are, in general, guys read books that have male. Right.
I don't think that's how it was for me. I don't think I read primarily male books growing up.
I don't think you could help but read primarily male books growing up, because I think mostly the books that are in most classical libraries are predominantly written by men.
I read Austen.
And outside of anybody with Jane the last Eyre. Name Bronte or Austen.
And go. I read a lot of Madeline L'Engle growing up.
There's like five books by Madeline L'Engle. Good, go. Keep going.
A lot of Madeline L'Engle books. I think I read all of them.
Yes, but the only ones that are still published are.
So, I mean, I think.
So you named a few female authors.
Right.
But like, if you had to start listing off all the male authors, I think you would I think it would be revealed to you. Like, maybe you didn't make the conscious choice that John did, but just by default, it probably has ended up that way. And if you, I don't know, do you keep track of the books that you read now? If you look back over the last 10 books you read, what are the odds that there'd be 9 male authors and 1 female?
Not high, but
lots of Ursula Le Guin.
Okay. Oh yeah, we got you on Ursula Le Guin.
Because we've all been on Ursula Le Guin kick.
Yeah.
But no, I think as an adult, I'm far more open-minded about that. But as a kid, I'm not.
Well, you know, in the school I teach at, our curriculum, it's not just 90% male; it's 98.5% male.
Have we talked about this in relationship to composers? Like, there are almost female composers. Almost none of substance.
Why?
Historically?
Why?
Historically, yeah.
Because women weren't afforded the training?
I think that's certainly part of it. It's just interesting.
But that certainly wouldn't be anymore. So why?
There are of like, acknowledged high repute. It's not like you're going to go and hear symphonies by a female.
Right,
composer.
So, like back in the day, hundreds of years ago, males, of course, had more privilege for training
How
and learning.
How in the world
right?
did we get to this conversation? Where are
I
we?
I don't know. But David hasn't told us what book
I know,
changed
but,
his.
But what I'm saying
life.
Right now, and I'm getting to that. But okay. But what I'm saying now is, in today's world, where women have just as much access.
Well, you're also assuming that
they're constantly getting stopped by people with rapey tendencies, and that limits their ability.
And I was actually just going to seriously say, you're discounting the fact that there might be systemic structures and that would influence that. Like, you say just as much access, but,
well,
you
I
know,
think
there are not, like, most symphonies are not conducted by women.
No.
There are hardly any. Well, until they introduced blind auditions, they wouldn't hire female musicians for orchestras. They had to introduce blind auditions in order to get women even into orchestras.
Well, and there's
and
systemic
like,
things. And
like
there's
a 25-year-old rule, not like a 200-year-old rule.
And then there's just the practical reality that women have children.
Yep.
And are home. And are raising kids.
Right.
And that is a historical reality up until very recently. And so
well, and
those
even
prime
with the, our
years
current
where they're developing
anomaly
your,
of being yeah. able to choose, mm-hmm, like
right.
the vast majority of us do want to have children.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that comes with cost.
That comes with cost. Yeah, because you're having children, mm-hmm. raising children, and often the people that you see that are incredibly either commercially successful or artistically vaunted are people who have made personal sacrifices in the area or of family.
And a female essayist called them art monsters.
art monsters.
Right. So people who are like monstrous. Picasso. Well, yes. And Hemingway.
Yeah, Hemingway. Would you elect Hemingway as a, or not elect, but appoint him as a judge based off of his personal character? How about Picasso?
No.
How about...
So you're saying if you have any tendencies, when you're young, you can go be an artist.
Yes.
You're 17,
oh,
you like Picasso? Is that what you
mean? Now, all of our art is being made by... I don't know.
Not all art. Not all art. No, and I don't think all artists or all composers were...
No, but there, there is something about very high level of art or business or much of anything that requires great sacrifices, and which may call into question certain levels of quote unquote excellence.
Exactly.
And dedicating oneself to it.
Right.
But
there's a reason we're called to a quiet and peaceful life.
And I do think, though, to just a comment on the women bear children, and that will derail your composing career or your artistic career. I think that that's something that we as a church should do more to honor and, I don't know. Do more to honor than to dismiss. Well, you know, there aren't as many women published authors because, you know, women have to have babies. And so now we're just going to move on with life. Like, I think that we should honor that as a sacrifice, much like we would honor a soldier going to war, and much like we would honor any other kind of great personal sacrifice, because it, not just be like, oh, well, women aren't going to do those things as much, and we're just going to be happy to go on with our lives without acknowledging that or doing what we can to assist in that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's been pretty clear that women, that mothers... are that that mothering is in that same category as there's like certain careers that are kind of like second class type of things. Oh, you're a full-time mom. So nice that you can stay home. Melissa's talked about this a little bit
right.
with working here the last couple of years. Is she, there are many people in our social circles who, when she would go into the social situations, whether they were work parties or just casual conversations with people at church or acquaintances, and she, and they would say, well, what is it that you do? She goes, I'm a stay-at-home mom. They would be, oh, that's nice. But now that she can talk about the job, they even women can say to her, oh, well, tell me about that. They don't want to hear about Melissa and what she does as a mom. They don't want to hear about Melissa and her insights as a mother, or you know, her philosophy on kids or homeschooling or those kinds of things, but they're happy to hear about her as a music teacher at a school, and that is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think
maybe
there's definitely
something about the mundanity of it that blinds us to its the greatness that's there, or the self-sacrifice that's there.
David,
book.
What book changed? We're transitioning back badly.
Smooth job. David. Go.
I'm having so much fun podcasting with you two. So, Amanda, you were talking about reading
Anybody
Totally
listening
Has Faces.
To this thinks we're probably all like a bunch of psychotic nuts because with it we are.
So they can accurately read us?
They don't know the truth. So, Amanda, I was smiling to myself over here because you said you read Till You Have Faces when you were 20 or 21.
Right.
And I remember exactly when I read Till We Have Faces. I was 21 and I remember it because I was living in Boise. I had just moved to Boise and I decided I'm going to read
this
book today.
Right.
And I went in the morning and I started reading. And I remember like driving over to the park, to Ann Morrison Park. And I sat down and I read in the park for just hours. And I came home and I read and I finished the whole book in a single day.
That's amazing.
And you're thinking to yourself, a whole book in a single day? That's not very impressive. But it was really impressive for me.
No, it is impressive. It just depends on what the book is.
Yeah. And I remember really loving the book.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was a book that I just kind of got overwhelmed by.
Mm-hmm.
Like just over and over, I would be overwhelmed by the truth just screaming at you. But I don't think there was anything in there that really changed my life in a way. It could be, you know, it could be. I think there's a lot of things that we read and truths that we hit that get to us at a very deep, subtle level mm-hmm. that we don't even realize we've been changed.
Right. And to make that list of books would take a while.
It really would. It really would. So I have two books. One is pretty silly and one is a little more serious like yours. The silly one, I thought that The Princess Bride was such a phenomenal...
Wait. Are you being dismissive about one of the great works of 20th century art?
S. Morgenstern. I thought that I enjoyed reading it so much. I thought it was the first book I think that I've read where the author did such a good job of switching back and forth between reality and not reality, mm-hmm. and the reality wasn't even reality. Mm-hmm. And he did such a good job of confusing you and right. entertaining you on an entirely other level.
Right, and the playfulness of that. It was like a
new medium.
Right. And the playfulness of that spoke to you.
Yes.
Because you went on to do that yourself with a book.
I did. Yes. Now that you mention it, I have written
a book. Well, the purpose of that book is very much to entertain. Mm-hmm. Like, as opposed to the books that we're talking about, which is to make you think, which I'm not dismissing that there's parts of The Princess Bride that are thoughtful, but the really...
And parts of Till We Have Faces that are entertaining,
right.
But you just wrapped up in the moment.
Like, the purpose of The right. Princess Bride is to make you smile.
Yes.
It's
very good at that.
Yes.
But regardless of the purpose, I was blown away by the method.
Right.
Right.
And
right,
that
right.
is, I think, is an, what really
an innovative structure.
Yes. I saw a movie this last week that did the same thing for me.
Which was?
It was called Searching. And the entire... I've never seen a movie like this. The entire movie is told through the guy's computer screen.
What?
Wow.
The entire movie is told through his computer screen. So you see, you know, it starts with Windows 3.1 booting up. And whoa. Creating an account, and then Windows 95, and you see like
is this like years. A movie you saw in the theater?
Yes, and it is so well done. It's like all like FaceTimes. You see the guy in the FaceTime video talking with people and reading emails, and it's such a well-told thriller story in this totally unique medium. Mm-hmm. It was really powerful, and mm-hmm. I love something that comes at you with such
so
a
innovative
fresh,
form.
Innovative form.
Yeah.
Thinking, you know, if you just told the story of The Princess Bride without that unique form, there's nothing really that special about it.
Right.
If you told this thriller story, there's nothing that's that unique about it.
Right.
But when you have a really unique method, mm-hmm. delivery mechanism, I think that's what makes it really special.
Okay.
So, and for what it's worth... Of on the top of the list of movies that I wish could be updated but never remade is The Princess Bride.
What do you mean by updated?
Like it hasn't aged well. Like if you go back really? And you watch it, I feel like it's really, really, like the cinematography is not good.
Oh,
and
the
sets are really hokey and cheesy and clearly.
But isn't that kind of the beauty of it? Kind of the cheesiness? Like they're kind of cheesy on purpose, I think.
Yeah, to some extent. But it has not aged well. Like when I've shared it to my kids enjoy it. But there's parts where they're like, it's hard to get into for them because it hasn't aged well.
Like how the RUOS is just so
exactly.
ridiculous.
Exactly. And even in like, I think the Star Wars movies have aged much better than The Princess Bride has. The special effects and the scenes and the fake stuff in those movies is better than The Princess Bride. You can tell it was a lower budget movie. Having said that, please, please, please do not remake that movie.
There's just no way to...
You can't
go.
No, you cannot find Andre the Giant again.
No,
you cannot,
there is no
Wesley
one.
It can't be a different actor than Wesley. It can't be a different
Mandy
actor.
Mandy Patinkin is...
No.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
it.
They're all like 60.
We're done.
Yeah, don't remake it. But
yeah.
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 All right. And what's your serious book?
My serious book, when I was a teenager, I read Fantastis by George
that
MacDonald.
Makes total sense, yeah.
And then I read Lilith. And
that's another medium bending book.
Yes.
Both things have, right. There's a theme there.
Form is really important for you.
Yeah. for both of those books, especially Lilith, are so hard to get your arms around. Yeah. You don't really understand. It's almost like an abstract painting. You don't really understand. You can't understand what's going on because it's so crazy. And I just felt myself being pulled along. It was like a dream. Mm-hmm. Being pulled into a story that I couldn't understand. I couldn't get my arms around what was happening where, but the writing was so powerful and the story was told so beautifully that it didn't even matter that I couldn't understand anything about this story. Yeah. And the themes of truth and love and right. beauty and honor and bravery were so present in the story mm-hmm. that I was really moved by those mm-hmm. and really loved those stories. There's this line I was looking for it earlier and I can't find it. I've got it written down somewhere. There's this line from Phantastis that I've just always loved so much. MacDonald had such a wonderful way with words, and he was talking about how this guy was on a boat in the middle of the lake. And he was, the moon was shining on the lake. And as the boat moved, the shape of the moon would break and fuse together mm-hmm. like the ripples of laughter as it fused into the still face of joy. And I just, oh my goodness.
Really good.
I read that and I think I was, 16 and I just wrote it down where this is. And I've
That's
always
awesome.
Like kept that because I wanted yeah. to remember the beauty of that moment, that little line.
That's really good.
So.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else to say.
That was a good note to end on then.
I'm thinking yeah. back and I don't know. I'm thinking back to what you had to say earlier about the characters that you found the strongest characters from the mm-hmm. from Lewis, and I not that I would disagree with any of the three that you chose, but I do think it is interesting, and I think this may in some ways in a unique way tie back to how we had the conversation at the beginning of what kinds of leaders we want and what things right. are disqualifying. The characters that I have found the most helpful in Lewis's writing tend to be characters on either end of the spectrum. So it's characters like Eustace mm-hmm. or Edmund who have major issues in their lives that they have to be redeemed from.
Right.
Or it's a character like Puddleglum, who is incredibly humble mm-hmm. and yet through his humility and his simplistic way of looking at the world becomes really the hero that is needed
right.
in a circumstance.
Right.
And his
quiet faithfulness.
His quiet faithfulness.
Or is just his-ness, his Puddleglumness
yes.
being what's needed.
Being what he is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And living that fully.
Right. But I find, I love Lucy and I love her, her openness and her simple childlike faith,
mm-hmm.
but I find Eustace far more helpful at an individual right. level, or Puddleglum far more helpful right. at an individual level. And I think that's what Lewis gets right so much of the time, where he's pointing us to either broken heroes or not anti-heroes. So I think that we're all about these these heroes that are so broken
right.
that somehow...
Well, he has no dark and tortured heroes. He has flawed human beings who grow.
Right,
right.
right.
Well, and I think that, in his nonfiction or in fiction like Screwtape Letters or Great Divorce, you really see his gift for identifying moral failing
mm-hmm.
and the pattern that it takes in the human heart and the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone like Eustace or Edmund is incredibly diagnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that's exactly what's wrong with my heart. I'm greedy in this way, mm-hmm. or I'm, resentful
in this
way. I'm
a dragon and I can't get rid of this.
Right.
This yeah. skin that I have chosen. Yeah.
Right. Or I'm fondling over a resentment instead of forgiving it. Or I'm...
Interesting choice of words given the topic that...
Oh my goodness, you would do that. You're worse than my students.
Oh my goodness. I couldn't believe you did.
But isn't that,
I was sure you chose that,
exact,
that on purpose. Yeah.
Isn't that the exact picture of nursing our hurts? Or,
yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like we take them out and turn them over and look at them and revisit them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's so incredibly diagnostic that way. And I think that that's one of the things that really resonated for me with Arul, is that her need to be needed and her need to center herself is, maybe too painful, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
we've talked for a long time.
We have. I think we probably ought to wrap it up.
Maybe we should make it not 5 million years next time before we get back together.
That's probably true. I don't edit it anymore, John.
Oh, boy.
He gave up on that.
So whatever you people hear is what you heard. So.
Man, nobody's going to ever listen to this ever again. All right, well, I got a good song to go out on. This is Need to Breathe, and it's called Forever on Your Side.
I'm David.
I'm Amanda.
And I'm John.